Today on Focus, we're taking your questions on personal finance. And retirement is on the minds of our guests, Chartered Financial Analyst Kevin Wasby and U of I Extension Educator Kathy Sweetler. Illinois' new pension reform law gives state employees the option of a defined contribution plan similar to a 401k, an option that's on the rise with many employers. But when is a defined contribution plan the right choice for retirement? And how late in life can you begin one and get a good return? I'm Jim Meadows. That's one of the topics our guests will discuss today. And your personal finance questions are welcome. That's today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WYLL. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. While we're not taking calls this hour, you can join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Even if you've never been to Bloomington Normal and McLean County, you may have a pretty steady picture of it anyway. They're both college towns, Bloomington and Normal, thanks to Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan Universities. Bloomington is big on insurance with the headquarters of State Farm and Country Financial. Normal is home to the only Mitsubishi auto plant in North America. But there's a lot more beyond those present-day features in the history of Bloomington Normal, and our guest today knows a lot about it. He should. Since 2005, Bill Kemp has been writing a local history column for the Pantograph, a page from our past the 400-column mark just a couple of weeks ago. And you can read 75 of those columns in Kemp's book, Pages from Our Past. It's published by the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington, where Kemp is the museum librarian. And Bill, welcome to the show here in Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And you're also welcome you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about the history of Bloomington Normal, McLean County? Bill did not bring his files with him, but maybe he can answer it off the top of his head. And if you have a tidbit of local history to share, we'd like to hear from you as well. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. You know, I was, it's a fascinating book, and I've been to Bloomington Normal. I haven't really lived in it or anything, but there's just seems like a lot of history has passed through that area.
Well, I think Bloomington Normal is really no different than a lot of communities in the United States or anywhere else for that matter. And certainly in Central Illinois, a lot of communities, whether it's Springfield or Decatur or Rantoul or Champaign-Urbana or Bloomington Normal or Peoria, in many ways they share a similar history. They're all different in their own way, but they have a lot in common. And I think you could explore any of those communities in depth and learn something new almost every day. As you mentioned, I've written 400 columns for the Sunday Pantograph, the daily paper in Bloomington, and I've yet had to repeat myself. And people are always amazed by that fact. But I think in any community of considerable size, there are so many stories, so many characters, so many peculiar events, famous people stopping through and what have you, that the stories are innumerable.
Okay. I'm thinking of maybe going back to the beginning, not the very beginning, because you even go back to wars between European settlers and Native Americans in the region. But let's go back to the founding of Bloomington, did it actually occur on the 4th of July?
Correct. Bloomington is born, if you will, on July 4th, 1831. Now, the county of McLean is organized or established by the state legislature. In 1830, the state capital was in Vandalia, not Springfield, of course. So McLean County is carved out of another county and established on Christmas Day, 1830. Yes, the legislature was meeting on Christmas Day in 1830, which should tell you that the Christmas holiday was not that important in the mid-19th century as it is to us today. So the county is established in 1830, but the county seat is not organized. So the first city lots for the county seat, Bloomington, are sold on July 4th, 1831. Bloomington is situated just north on the northern edge of Blooming Grove, which is a which was a timbered tract of about 6,200 acres. McLean County, like a lot of counties in central Illinois when it was first established, first inhabited by Euro-Americans or white settlers, was primarily tall grass prairie. About 88 to 90% of McLean County was tall grass prairie, but you did have significant timber tracts, and oftentimes those were referred to as groves. So you had Funk's Grove and Randolph's Grove and Blooming Grove. So Bloomington is established just on the northern edge of Blooming Grove.
And are there any remnants of Blooming Grove today that somebody could identify, or has it all been chopped down?
There are a few small little corners of Blooming Grove with a few isolated tracts of close to virgin timber, but very little bit of Blooming Grove survives. Now, other groves in McLean County, the most famous being Funk's Grove, which is off Interstate 55 south of Bloomington, part of that, the original grove, is still intact, yes.
Okay, and that sounds maybe similar to other settlements. We're speaking now in our studios in Urbana, and Champaign and Urbana were founded just off of a big grove called Big Grove.
Correct.
There are remnants of it in the area, but most of it seems to have gone down.
And the first white settlers in McLean County, they arrive in the early 1820s, and they settle, for the most part, on the edge of the wooded grove. The prairie is difficult to plow because of the thickly matted prairie roots. The prairie is a wood desert, if you will, so the first settlers are inhabiting the edge area between the timber and the prairie so they can make use of the wood resources and also slowly venture out onto the prairie for agriculture. So if you look at what's the oldest thing in Bloomington, it would be the streetscape, the layout of the original Old Town streets, which dates to early July 1831. The oldest buildings come a little bit later in the mid-1830s and then into the 1840s and 50s.
Now, I was just looking at that area, which you describe as the original layout of Bloomington. I was looking at a map on Google and trying to figure out one thing that's there now. One thing is there is your employer, the McLean County Museum of History. They're in an old McLean County courthouse, not the current one.
Correct.
But I take it that was a spot which may have been home to more than one McLean County courthouse
Correct.
Building.
The courthouse square right in the center of old historic downtown Bloomington was platted originally in July of 1831. So the square has been there since the very beginning. The McLean County Museum of History, I work for a nonprofit organization. I am not an employee of the County of McLean or the City of Bloomington. We're a standalone nonprofit organization. We now occupy the old county courthouse in Bloomington. That's actually the fourth courthouse in the county's history. The first courthouse is built in 1832. It's a wood frame structure. In 1836, a two-story federal-style courthouse is built, and that remains the county courthouse until 1868, when a substantial brick and stone courthouse is built. That third courthouse is lost in a great fire of June 19th, 1900. About 6.5 blocks of Bloomington are lost to a great fire. And then the building I inhabit, it takes several years to build, and that opens in 1903. And then the county later builds what's called the Law and Justice Center in the 1970s, and the county slowly moves out of the old courthouse where I work today, and the McLean County Museum of History moved in the early 1990s. So that's often mistaken as the original courthouse, and of course that's a 20th century building.
But it's the original courthouse site.
That is correct, yes.
And so that goes back to the whole idea is what's really the oldest thing in Bloomington is the layout of
absolutely
the streets.
Absolutely correct, yes. And Abraham Lincoln practiced law quite a lot in Bloomington. We like to say that he spent more time in Bloomington than any other community from the time he becomes a lawyer in the late 1830s until he heads to Washington, D.C. in early 1861 to become president of the United States. He's in Bloomington more than any other community, obviously other than Springfield is home. So he's practicing law on the Courthouse Square of Bloomington. He's appearing there twice a year on the 8th Judicial Circuit. And that's the federal-style building that opens in 1836.
And he was mentored by a Bloomington resident, David Davis, am I correct?
Right. I don't know. Mentor might be too strong of a word, but one of his close associates and friends Though Lincoln had kind of a peculiar personality, and Davis does talk about that after Lincoln's death, that nobody really knew the true character of Lincoln, even some of his closest friends, like Judge David Davis, who was the judge on the 8th Judicial Circuit. Lincoln appoints Judge Davis from Bloomington to the U.S. Supreme Court during Lincoln's presidency.
Okay. We have a caller here who I think is going to try to pose a question with you. I don't know if this is in your expertise line, but let's go ahead and say hello to William in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Yeah, boy, let's jump ahead 120 years to I lived at 1410 Franklin Avenue. And is it true that at that time we bragged that it was the only street in the world that had a university at both ends? Is that a rumor or is that true?
Well, I often hear that, and that University Street is the only street in the United States, evidently, that connects two universities, being Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington and Illinois State University in Normal. That's an often told tale, Bloomington Normal residents, and I cannot speak to the fact of whether that is true or not.
But I don't know if anyone's tried walking the streets and see if they get from one to the other.
Oh, wait a minute. I lived across from the Wesleyan Gym, which is at the one end of Franklin Avenue, and rode my bicycle to U-High, which was over at the Illinois State University at the other end.
Well, so the question is this the only one which has this particular situation?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I can't really speak to that, but you do hear that quite often, yes.
Yeah, and did you have a connection with the Pantograph? I heard that earlier.
Yes, correct. I write a weekly history column in the Sunday Pantograph, right, even though I'm not an employee of the Pantograph. I do that as a librarian for the museum. It's a way for us to get out the good word of local history.
I just wondered if an old U-High graduate, I think he's deceased, Ward Sinclair, I think he was the sports guy for the Pantograph back in the early 50s. Ever hear of him? Probably not.
No, I had not.
History. Okay. Thanks for the
thank you.
Information. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you. And, you know, that does bring to mind another former Pantograph correspondent that I wanted to bring up, and that was at least for a short time, Adlai Stevenson II, who would go on to become governor and a two-time presidential candidate and then the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. I wanted to play a clip, if we have it ready, just to refresh people's memories. This is Adlai Stevenson when he was running for president in 1956 against Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes, I think there's much to be done. We must see to it that the small family farmer gets a fair share of the national prosperity. We must see to it that the small businessman gets the help that he needs to survive in this time of giants. We must provide security in their old age for our elder citizens. And we must face the grim fact that today 30 million Americans live in families trying to make ends meet on less than $2,000 a year.
And that was Adlai Stevenson II, former governor, I believe, by that time, on the campaign trail for a second time in 1956, his second unsuccessful campaign against Republican Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes, he had the misfortune of running against a popular war hero, Dwight David Eisenhower, and few Democrats were going to beat Eisenhower both in 52 and 1956, and Stevenson gives it his best, but it's a long road to hoe, that's for sure.
And I gathered in some way Stevenson had some strikes against him. He was considered a pretty smart guy, which might have been too smart in the eyes of some. He was a little off of the middle American generality. He was a Unitarian. He was divorced. Not the sort of things that you would expect to see running for the White House. But he was the Democratic nominee. And when he was much younger, he was a reporter for the Pantograph. And you write in one of your columns that appear in the pages from the past book about how he covered the horrible tri-state tornado back in 1925 that hit southern Illinois and Indiana. And was it Missouri or was it?
Correct, right. The It's the deadliest tornado in American history. March 18th, 1925, the tri-state tornado kills almost 700 people. It was on the ground, if you could imagine, for 3.5 hours. Begins in Missouri, cuts through southern Illinois, and actually ends up in Indiana. And Adlai Stevenson at that time was in his mid-20s. He had just, believe it or not, flunked out of Harvard Law School. He was a Princeton grad. He has a reputation as an intellectual, as an egghead, as a wonderful writer. All those things are true in a way, but he really wasn't the best student. He ends up getting a law degree eventually from Northwestern University. But he flunks out of Harvard, comes back to his boyhood home of Bloomington, where his parents live. He lives at home on East Washington Street on the near east side of Bloomington, and he works for the family paper because his family owns a considerable stake in the Pantograph, which is the longtime daily newspaper of Bloomington and still is to this day. And that will be Stevenson's main source of income, being a shareholder in the Pantograph until his death. And except for a few years as an adult, that will be his main source of income, even when he was governor, runs for president, serves as ambassador to the United Nations. He is very well-to-do, well-off, and a lot of that income is coming from the Pantograph. But in his mid-20s, he is dispatched down to southern Illinois to cover the tri-state tornado. He had worked as the telegraph editor. He had worked in sales for the Pantograph. He was trying to get a sense of the newspaper business. And he goes down to Murfreesboro and writes several articles. And you can see at an early age, in his mid-20s, that he really had a knack to turn a phrase and to write quite beautifully. His prose was almost a little too purple, if you will, for journalism.
And of course, we don't know how styles have changed over the years. Were you able to get an idea when you read those old articles? Do you think you were getting all the information that that a good reporter would get out of from covering that disaster?
Well, he was there more as a feature writer, so he was providing some of the color, kind of the first-person accounts, whereas the Pantograph, I believe, at that time was relying on the news wires to provide kind of the meat and potatoes of the coverage. Stevenson was there just to kind of provide a little bit of additional coverage.
Now, Stevenson, the Stevenson family, I think shortly after that, Adlai Stevenson II left Bloomington Normal. He didn't live there after that. But the Stevenson family had been part of Bloomington Normal for a long time.
Correct. McLean County has long been known as a Republican county. Very rare for, although that is changing, McLean County in some ways, if we look at contemporary politics, is moving from a red county into, if you will, a purple county. But certainly, Adlai Stevenson II, the Adlai Stevenson we've been talking about, once said that he had a bad case of hereditary politics because his father, Lewis, served briefly as Secretary of State of Illinois, and his grandfather, Adlai I, the odd name Adlai skips a generation, so we're talking about Adlai's grandfather, Adlai E. Stevenson I, served as vice president during Grover Cleveland's second administration from 1893 to 1897. He ran as the vice presidential candidate in 1900 under William Jennings Bryan, a losing race against McKinley. And then Adlai I actually ran for governor in 1908 and lost. And if you look at the Stevensons, both in the 1892 presidential race and the 1900 presidential race, and then in Adlai II's 1952 and 1956 races, the Stevensons go 0-for-4 in McLean County, meaning they did not win the majority of McLean County voters. So,
how did Adlai Stevenson III, who was a U.S. senator, I think, in the 70s
correct,
and his 80s, was he able to win McLean County?
I don't believe so. I don't know that for sure, but I'd believe not, right. Adlai III, the son of Adlai II, who's still alive today, living in Chicago. He has a farm also in the Galena area. He keeps in contact with our museum because we hold some papers and other material from the Stevenson family. He was a U.S. senator in the 1970s and is still somewhat active in the Bloomington Normal area because the Stevensons still feel they have a connection to Bloomington Normal.
Well, that's interesting. And I know they haven't been active in politics, but there is an Adlai Stevenson IV who was involved in the news media. And there, if you look at the Daily Illini and the Weekly Buzz Entertainment publication, they also put out You'll see from time to time the byline of what I gather is a fifth Adlai Stevenson.
That is correct.
Maybe not from Bloomington Normal anymore, but
no.
But it's certainly the family is still very much around.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about the history of Bloomington Normal, McLean County, and thereabouts with Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History. He writes the page from the past column in the Sunday Pantograph. If you have a question about local history, as are some history to share, call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. I want to skip chronologically back again because I was very much struck by the Underground Railroad and the role that Bloomington Normal played in the Underground Railroad in the years before the Civil War. And really, it might be better to say that some people in Bloomington Normal played in the Underground Railroad. I gather that Bloomington Normal wasn't necessarily a big abolitionist town.
That is correct. If you look at Bloomington, the county seat of McLean County, not really a hotbed for abolitionist sentiment. Bloomington,
at the time, would they have been more Republican or Whig rather than Democrat?
Well, Bloomington early on in the 1830s and into the 1840s was, and I'm generalizing here, was settled by upland Southerners, people with Southern roots and backgrounds. So there was very little agreement with the abolitionist sentiment at the time. That begins to change in the 1850s with the rise of the Republican Party opposing the expansion of slavery into northern territories. And Bloomington becomes much more interested in the slavery issue by that time. But in McLean County, there were two areas involved in the Underground Railroad. That would be Mount Hope, which is a Congregationalist settlement, New Englanders primarily, in southern McLean County. And then you had a small community north of Bloomington Normal called Pleasant Hill. And that's where you saw some abolitionist activity. I became interested in the Underground Railroad locally because if you talk to people involved in local history, whether they work for a genealogy society or a historical society like I do, very few facets of American history are so enveloped in legend and lore and myths as the Underground Railroad. Oftentimes, any old building in a community, somehow that will be confused with a stop on the Underground Railroad. And I became fascinated with all the myths that really obscure the importance of the Underground Railroad. For example, beginning in the 1980s, we began to read about freedom quilts, the idea that station managers on stops on the Underground Railroad would drape quilts for escaped slaves to read hidden messages in the quilts. We now know that to be complete bunk. There are no accounts of secret messages on quilts in the entire history of the Underground Railroad. You also hear stories of tunnels and secret passageways and secret chambers where slaves would hide. And if you look at all the accounts of escaped slaves into the North, heading to Canada or New England or what have you, whether that's false walls or cellars or secret rooms or tunnels, very, very little of that. Oftentimes nothing more exotic than a hayloft in a barn where an escaped slave is being hidden.
So do we know where escaped slaves were housed and assisted in McLean County?
We do have accounts of escaped slaves coming through the Mount Hope, the Congregationalist community I had talked about, and also Pleasant Hill North. And we do have one account of a slave in September 1853. Oftentimes, escaped slaves, freed people, once they made it to freedom, would write a detailed narrative of their escape, and that would be published in the abolitionist press. And we have one account of a field hand from Missouri, John Anderson, making his way from Missouri through Illinois up to Chicago and then on to Canada. And he became quite a celebrity because he had killed a slave catcher in Missouri. So he was charged for murder once he escaped to Canada. There were two trials. He was eventually acquitted and able to live his life as a free man in Canada, but it was kind of a celebrated case. And we know for a fact that this John Anderson comes through Bloomington on his way north.
Okay. The places and the organizations or settlements involved in the Underground Railroad back in that time, more than 150 years ago, Does anything exist of them today of this particular church congregation or Pleasant Hill, for that matter?
Yeah, nothing survives of Mount Hope, not even a building. That today is corn and soybean fields.
Did the church congregation merge into another church congregation?
Yeah, I think a lot of these kind of, it wasn't a utopian colony, but a lot of these kind of New England or Eastern settlements or colonies, these kind of settlements kind of dissipated and died away. So there wasn't one event that kind of that led to the end of Mount Hope. Certainly the Chicago and Mississippi, later the Chicago and Alton Railroad, is laid out not too far from Mount Hope, and the new town of McLean is built, and that also spells doom for Mount Hope, the colony as well. My favorite story relating to the Underground Railroad in McLean County, I was an undergraduate student at Illinois State University in the early and mid-1980s, and I was told that one of the most magnificent farmhouses in all of Illinois is called Towanda Meadows. It's just north of Normal, between Normal and the small town of Towanda. This three-story Italianate brick farmhouse, it's just a striking building, and you can see that from Interstate 55 or Amtrak as you're traveling between St. Louis and Chicago. Three-story Italianate farmhouse. Everybody that grows up in Bloomington Normal is told that's a stop on the Underground Railroad. The problem with that is Towanda Meadows, also known as Duncan Manor, this farmhouse, wasn't built until the mid-1870s, a full decade after the end of the Civil War, which makes it kind of absurd to be a stop on the Underground Railroad.
I'm looking at a picture online. If you go to duncanmanor.info and a lot of other dot things as well, there's a picture of it. That was one rich farmer who built that building.
William R. Duncan, he is from Kentucky, moves up to McLean County during the Civil War because he's a Union man. Kentucky's in chaos. His local neighbors are kind of frowning on his politics, and he moves up to McLean County, becomes a leading livestock farmer, involved in the local agricultural association and improving blooded stock. There's another story related to Towanda Meadows, another urban legend or myth, if you will, about the Underground Railroad, and that there was a hidden room for slaves to hide on the second floor
of Towanda Meadows.
Correct.
Duncan Manor.
Correct. And a hidden room, a treasure room, where you could ferret away slaves if slave catchers are stopping by. And that's right under a second floor bedroom. But that, unfortunately, that secret room was a cistern for a bathroom on the first floor.
Not quite as romantic.
No.
Unfortunately, and probably just as well that it was not used as a stop on the Underground Railroad. Thinking of that does lead inevitably in U.S. history to the Civil War, and of one of the, and I'm sure you've written a lot of columns about McLean County's involvement with the Civil War.
Correct.
But the one that caught my eye from the pages from the past book was the one about Private Albert D.J. Cashier, who served honorably as an infantryman in the Civil War for the Union Army and later moved to a little town in Livingston County, Sonoman, only a few hundred people now, maybe the same size back then. And he had a big secret.
Right. Albert D.J. Cashier enlists in the Union Army in the 95th Illinois Volunteer Infantry Regiment in 1862 out of Belvidere, Illinois. Participates in the epic Siege of Vicksburg, Mississippi, one of the grand Union victories in all the Civil War. Vicksburg, Mississippi being the last Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River. Vicksburg falls July 4th, 1863, the same weekend of the Battle of Gettysburg. That's really the beginning of the end for the Confederacy, although the war lasts almost two more years. Private Albert D.J. Cashier is there for the Red River March in Louisiana almost three full years. And like a lot of Illinois regiments, the 95th is fighting in what's called the Western Theater. So that includes Alabama and Mississippi and Western Tennessee and Louisiana and Texas. And Albert is born in the 1840s in Ireland and arrives in the United States. We're not quite sure when. Becomes a farmhand. We believe Albert is illiterate. And Albert enlists in the Union Army. And Albert's great secret is that Albert was a woman.
We didn't, and no one found that out, apparently, at least no one that told until much later in life, really when Albert was in his 60s and when he was severely injured.
Correct. Albert is a relatively unusual person and keeps that secret, as far as we know, during a three-year enlistment in the 95th
When a lot
regiment.
Of the times he would have been living rough, sleeping on the ground, et cetera, et cetera.
And after the fact, once the secret comes out much later, long after the Civil War, some of Albert's fellow soldiers in the 95th would comment, you know, Albert was a trustworthy, very brave private, could always be counted on to do the dirtiest of dirty work, but would never bathe with fellow soldiers, would always button his collar to hide the fact that Albert was a woman and had no Adam's apple and things of that nature, and was a rather quiet individual and kept to himself. Albert, after the Civil War, eventually settles in Sonneman, which is a small town in Livingston County just east of the county seat of Pontiac. And when Albert is in his mid-60s, is doing some kind of handyman work for a state senator, Ira Lish, who lives in Sonneman. And Ira Lish accidentally backs over Albert, an aged Albert, in the driveway and breaks Albert's leg right about at the point of the hip. And a doctor is summoned, and the physician and the senator, Ira Lish, lo and behold, discover that Albert is indeed a woman. Albert is sent to the Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Home in Quincy, Illinois. It's kind of a veterans home for Civil War veterans. And then Albert is suffering from physical disabilities and also mental health issues. Dementia, and is sent to... Okay. Sent to East Moline at the Watertown State Hospital and dies in 1915.
And I wonder exactly how Albert was thought of at the time. I mean, somebody who was biologically a woman presenting as a man might have been thought to have mental health issues on those grounds alone. I thought the interesting thing is what you wrote is that when he's initially injured, it sounds like they agreed to keep his secret.
Right. There was an attempt to respect the privacy of Albert, who evidently wanted to keep this a secret. So they attempt to in Quincy at the veterans home, and then but evidently, obviously, the secret does get out. And Albert enjoys somewhat a kind of a celebrityhood or notoriety in the local presses. And there's really no negativity. Albert is treated as a war hero, as one would hope, and... you know, we now as a society struggle with these issues of gender and sexuality and these issues. But again, obviously back then these just were not discussed at all. So the fact of why did Jenny Hodgers, Albert's real name, why did Jenny become Albert? That really wasn't much discussed. The emphasis was on that Albert was an exemplary soldier in the Union cause. And when Albert is buried in Sonneman, my favorite part of the story is that the grave marker just reads Company G, 95th Illinois Infantry, Albert DJ Cashier. No mention the fact that Albert was a woman. So,
but in the 1970s, somebody adds a second little stone saying born Jenny Hodgers.
Correct. Because
do we know who did that?
No, I don't know offhand. It could have been the Sonneman Historical Society. The town of Sonneman, the village, deserves a lot of credit for restoring Jenny Hodgers, Albert Cashier's small home, and now that's a local historic site. They've done a really good job of keeping up the memory. I think the change was made in the 1970s just because this is kind of a well-known local Civil War story, and people were going to visit the cemetery, and they needed some additional information provided.
Okay. Before we go into the break, I want to take one more call and say hello to Paul from Champaign County. I believe, Paul, good morning. I understand you had a comment about Pleasant Hill that we were talking about a little bit earlier concerning the Underground Railroad.
Right. Well, I actually wanted to ask, I don't know how that actually got translated that way, about this
Pleasant Hill.
Pleasant Hill, yeah. I've just read about that a little bit. it's still a vibrant African American community. And
no, I think you're confusing now with another community in southern Illinois, closer to St. Louis. Pleasant Hill is north of Bloomington Normal. That was never an African American settlement. And Pleasant Hill really withers and dies on the vine once the Chicago and Alton Railroad is laid out and the town of Lexington really grows.
Okay, yes. Well, so this isn't in the region, but I understand it goes back to the pre-Civil War days when freed slaves did find their way there.
Yes, and Illinois has several remarkable freed people, freed slave communities in southern Illinois, and even one, I believe, in Kankakee County as well.
Right. Well, there was one other thing, since that sort of didn't work out. And this is later in history. It's not so much Civil War times, but the NAACP was formed in like the aughts, and I believe it was 1908, and there was basically an attack on a rather bourgeois, you know, rather well-to-do African-American community after the pretext of a rape of a white woman, and the whole area was decimated, and many people fled. And I understand that some African-Americans in Champaign actually trace their lineage when they had to flee.
Yeah, yes.
And I was wondering if there's anything similar to that in Bloomington.
Yes, I think you're referring to the 1908 Springfield race riot.
Well, they call it a race riot, but it was an attack by whites on a...
Yeah, it was a white mob. There was a black man who had been accused of killing a white resident, and then another black man falsely accused of raping, sexually assaulting a white woman. That proves not to be true. And both individuals, African-Americans, are held at the Sangamon County Jail. A white mob descends on the jail, demands that these two individuals be lynched. The sheriff of Sangamon County sends these two African-American men awaiting trial, puts them on, sends them to Bloomington secretly to get them out of this very violent situation. Once the mob realizes they've left town, then a riot ensues, and these white residents of Springfield burn down the African-American residential and business neighborhoods of Springfield. And that the fact that this race riot occurs in Abraham Lincoln's hometown really is the beginnings of the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
It's really in defense of what in 1908 was an attack by whites on blacks.
Correct, right.
And did any of the black population from Springfield migrate to Bloomington?
Yes, you had an exodus of blacks from Springfield into communities such as Bloomington, Lincoln, Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, up to Chicago and elsewhere, right? Not that plenty of blacks remained in Springfield, but a lot of local black families in Central Illinois can trace their arrival to communities from the race riot.
Okay. I'm going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll still have some more time for some Bloomington Normal and McLean County history with Bill Kemp. This is Focus on WYLL. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today is Bill Kemp. He's the librarian over at the McLean County Museum of History in downtown Bloomington, and he's also the history columnist over at the Pantograph. The page from our past column appears every Sunday, I believe. There's also a book that the museum has published of Bill's columns called Pages from the Past. One of the ones that struck me looks at Bloomington Normal from the world of entertainment, and that's of a radio show which was well known in its day. Not well, a lot of people who, if you don't follow old-time radio, hard to say following old-time radio since old-time radio is no longer with us, but one of the bigger shows for a decade or more was a show called Vic and Sade, and its writer, the guy who wrote the whole thing, apparently, Paul Reimer, was from Bloomington.
Right. Paul Reimer was not born in Bloomington, but he's raised in Bloomington. He attends Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington, though he rarely would attend classes. He was kind of a character. It was said that he would check in every once in a while to see how things were going. He was more a fraternity brother, if anything. He ends up working for the Pantograph, the daily paper of Bloomington, though he's let go after the editors find out that he's writing about people that don't exist, and he's quoting people. He's making things up. So he's more of a fiction than a nonfiction writer. He goes up to Chicago and works for NBC and eventually develops a 15-minute radio program for the late morning, early afternoon. It's a soap opera, if you will, called Vic and Sade, and it is one of the most popular radio programs in the 1930s. And what's really of interest to me is the fact that Paul Reimer, who was obviously a brilliant writer, a genius, if you will, would write every 15-minute script that morning.
That morning.
Pound it out on the typewriter and give it to the cast. And he was such a wonderful writer that people like Edgar Lee Masters, the great Illinois poet, and Ogden Nash were big fans of this show because the writing was so beautifully constructed. There were only four characters that you ever heard on this show, and there were over 3,500 episodes. There was Vic and Sade Gook, rhymes with look, their foster son Rush, and then an Uncle Fletcher. But in addition to those four, there was a whole community of characters that you would learn about. Divorcee Cora Bucksaddle, Miss Applerot, Rush's teacher, the local minister, Reverend Kidney Slide, which has to be one of the best names ever for a Protestant minister, and Rishigan Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan. But you would learn about all these characters just through the discussions of Vic and Sade and their son and Uncle Fletcher, either their discussions amongst themselves or through phone calls, and you would just hear Vic, Sade, Rush, or Uncle Fletcher. But the writing was so involved and so rich that you would get a sense of these characters without ever hearing them speak at all.
I have a clip here from, I believe it's around 1941. I'll try to set it up. It's hard to set up a storyline on a show which really didn't seem to have much of a plot, but Vic is having a conversation with his son, Rush. Sade has taken over sponsorship of a party at the family home. Rush is lobbying to be allowed to run the party himself, arguing that it would be so much more exciting if he were in charge of the program.
Got any more fancy features?
Got plenty. For one thing, I'm going to call the fire department.
You don't contemplate livening up the party by setting the house on fire?
Oh, no.
I was somewhat apprehensive. I love to see people have fun at my home, but I draw the line.
Here's the angle. Along about 9:30 in the evening, party's kind of sag. Appreciate the angle I'm attempting to put across. Different guests start yawning, and the official host begins to get desperate. He wonders, what the heck could I better do to put some pep in things? Well, I got that problem solved. I'm going to telephone the fire department.
False alarm?
Sure. Everybody enjoys watching fire wagons. And these fire wagons will stop right in front of our house. Great sport for everybody.
I have a discouraging note.
Yeah?
There's a severe penalty for turning in false alarms.
Is there?
10 years in jail or something. You can see for yourself that while the fire engines are coming here on a false alarm, a real fire might break out somewhere and make it disagreeable all around.
Yeah. Well, guess I better cross that one off my list.
It might be the best thing.
That's a clip from Vic and Sade, and it's hard to really give an impression of the show just from a clip. It was not a big setup punchline sort of show. From listening to excerpts that you can find on YouTube, as I found that one, there was a sort of things tended to build up a little bit of absurdity one after the other. And although it was in a soap opera time slot presented as if it were a soap opera, there was almost no plot. One of the commenters on YouTube talked about it as sort of the Seinfeld of its day because it was about nothing. And it ran for over a decade, and Paul Reimer wrote the whole thing. And it's that really seems to be, I don't know if he did any other shows or books or other projects.
Yeah, he was involved in some spinoffs of Vic and Sade and did have a career a little bit after that. But he's really known today for Vic and Sade. And you are right, it was kind of an early Seinfeld in that it was a show about nothing. Some of the episodes have wonderful titles such as Cleaning a Bookcase, or my favorite, which would be A Slow, Dull, Tiresome evening. So I think what Reimer would do would create these absurd titles and construct a 15 minutes of dialogue in a Midwestern home based on this idea. And Vic and Say took place in a fictional town called Crooper, Illinois, but people in Bloomington Normal knew that Crooper was really a stand-in for Bloomington Normal because there would be references to places that they would be aware of. The Alton Depot on the west side, Miller Park, People's Bank, places like that. And the introduction of the show was always that the Gooks lived on Virginia Avenue in the small house halfway up the next block. And the Reimers, in fact, did live on Virginia Avenue in Normal.
I hear Paul Reimer's name at the beginning of the programs I was listening to. Was he known? Was he famous for being the author of Vic and Say? Was he a celebrity?
Yes, you would see accounts and in our files at the McLean County Museum of History, popular periodicals of the day, such as Time Magazine, would profile Reimer and Vic and Say. One popular weekly magazine compares Reimer's ability to turn Midwestern conversation, much like compares him to Mark Twain.
And I was just struck, even listening to the episodes that I caught, I couldn't see any hear any mention of Crooper, the town patterned after Bloomington, but they were constantly talking about people coming and visiting or going out to other towns in Illinois, Peoria, Hoopston, etc.
That's right.
Dixon. So the show was definitely knew where you were in that show, and that was in downstate Illinois.
And about 330 of the 3,500 episodes are extant, meaning survive in some format, and go to particular websites or Amazon, and you can order digital copies of some episodes.
Okay. I want to shift gears just to an entirely different subject with Bloomington Normal again before we run out of time. And that's about something that's more recent in its history and how student unrest in connection with the Vietnam War affected Bloomington Normal. I guess especially Illinois State University. Was there any campus unrest at Illinois Wesleyan?
Yes, there was at Illinois Wesleyan as well. Really, the high watermark, if you will, for student protests in the United States is really May 1970. On April 30th, 1970, Richard Nixon, the president, gives a speech to the nation announcing that the U.S. Armed Forces have begun to bomb Cambodia because the Viet Cong are active on the border between Cambodia and Vietnam. And that really enrages a lot of the left-leaning, leftist organizations on campuses throughout the country. On May 4th, four young people are killed at Kent State University in Ohio, right? The Neil Young song, Four Dead in Ohio. On May 5th, about 200 students from Illinois State University occupy Hovey Hall. Hovey Hall was the administration hall. So this was a common tactic at the time, right, to occupy the hall and make demands. And they make demands of ISU President Samuel Braden. But unlike a lot of university presidents, Braden's primary interest is keeping the university open. So he is willing to negotiate with students. And he says, okay, I will, as long as you promise to keep the university open, I will do things that you demand. And the students demanded that the ISU flag on the quadrangle, on the quad, be lowered to half staff for 6 days in honor of the four students or four young people killed at Kent State, and also in honor of two Black Panther Party leaders that were killed by the police, and also that the flag would have to be raised at half staff on May 19th for slain civil rights leader Malcolm X's birthday. The students agree. The campus will remain open if the flag is lowered at half staff for these reasons. And of course, that enrages people that support the war or that are anti-war. So at that time, there was a lot of construction on campus. You had a lot of hard hats or construction workers that opposed the student protesters. So a lot of the unrest on the ISU campus is involving lowering or raising the American flag on the center of the quad. But Braden says, because he gets a lot of flack from conservative senators, state senators in Springfield, he's called to a committee in Springfield, taken to the woodshed, if you will, criticized for bowing to the concerns of the students. But he says you could say that our flag is half staff, but our campus is open. And if you look at all the other public universities in Illinois, those campuses, though their flags are at full staff, those campuses are closed. Yes, Illinois State was the only campus to remain open for all of May of 1970.
And today, Samuel Braden is remembered with his name on the performance hall at the Bowen Student Center, the Braden Auditorium. So some people must have still liked him in later years.
Right. He resigns or retires or leaves the presidency at ISU about a month after the protests end. So I think it was a very, very difficult time to be a university president, no matter where you were. And I think he probably had enough. He was getting clobbered both on the left and both on the right. You know, Jim Hightower, the Texas politician and pundit, says the only thing in the middle of the road is a dead armadillo. I guess we could say in Central Illinois, it'd be a dead possum. But so if you try to be a moderate and appease both sides, sometimes you get run over. And I think that's what happened to President Braden here.
Okay. Well, that pretty much wraps up the time we have to talk about Bloomington Normal area history, a really fascinating area, with Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History, whose column appears every Sunday in the Pantograph. Are you working? Do you have an idea what's in this Sunday's column?
Yes, I'm writing about a World War II memorial fountain that's actually on the Courthouse Square. I often don't get to write about an area where I work every day, but it was a 1948 war memorial fountain for those that sacrificed for World War II.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for coming up on the program today. And I'm going to be thinking more every time I pass through Bloomington Normal about some of the history there. You can find Bill Kemp's employer online, the McLean County Museum of History, at mchistory.org. I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.